Succession number 21564, Wheel 28.
Colonel Cormac, Wheel 28. You mentioned seeing the Dutch forward brigade, as it were, at Hona. You've been mentioning the jokes about the long-haired conscripts with their hairnets and so forth. What impression did you get of their level of efficiency, that of the Dutch conscripts?
Really quite good. I mean, when you spoke to them, and quite a number were sufficiently fluent in English to have that sort of conversation, they gave the impression of actually being quite interested in what they were doing. Their approach to discipline was slightly different, but we've covered that. But no, when you talked to them, they said, yes, they were interested in what they were doing, and they could explain what they were doing. And in many cases, you got the impression they were quite pleased to be able to explain what they were doing, which I thought was quite encouraging. I mean, it varied a bit, but certainly, although I was mostly talking to officers and senior NCOs, the soldiers I did talk to certainly gave that impression. You obviously get the odd reluctant chap who's conscripted against his better judgment or wishes, but then you got that in our army when we had conscription. So I saw nothing unusual in that.
And you mentioned going to the Dutch engineering school. Did they have any distinctive characteristics which would have distinguished them from British engineers?
No, their approach to engineering was much more like ours, and Western Europe as a whole, than the Soviets. And they were much more flexible. Obviously, being a national service army, the emphasis was much more on doing one thing particularly well. But they had to have an all-round knowledge. There was no use a chap just being a bridging expert if he couldn't lay mines or couldn't clear mines, because that was part and parcel of it. But they would make more emphasis on one particular subject than we would, but they still retained the ability to do other things pretty well, and that was essential. So it was much nearer ours.
Were they developing any particularly distinctive pieces of equipment?
No. I didn't get the impression that they were in the weapons development business themselves. What they got, they bought. And they got from the best possible source. And again, they did have this idea of compatibility. And it would be between a British tank and a German tank or an American tank, because they were the three tanks that we were using in NATO overall, and the Northern Army Group in particular. So that the battle would be between which they would buy rather than which they would develop. I didn't get much impression that there was a Dutch arms industry as such. I think if they were to spend money on research and development, it would be on the naval side rather than the army.
One expect the Dutch to know about water and water obstacles.
Yes. Well, they had plenty of water obstacles to practice on, and that was second nature. Yes, they were good at bridging, but again, their approach was much the same as ours. The equipment was very similar, whereas it would be more German and American equipment than ours, but the approach was the same, and I find it very, very, very compatible. But we did one or two exercises on trying to become more standard. I think one thing, the rifle in those days was the SLR 7.62, and I think that was generally recognised as the calibre for small arms weapons. The artillery weapons, 120mm, again, there was a certain compatibility there. But when we actually got down to it, there wasn't nearly enough compatibility between all the countries in NATO and the equipments they use. There were and still are, I think, too many variations.
Well, there was a criticism at one time that standardisation essentially meant buying American.
Yes, that's a bit of a simplification. But there were numerous STANAGs, standardisation agreements, covering all sorts of things. And the rigmarole you had to go through to get those approved and signed by all the parts of Northern Army Group had to be seen to be believed.
Well, major commercial interests would be involved, wouldn't they? The question always arises, who is going to manufacture?
Yes, that's right, and who's going to make all the spare parts and who's going to provide... that was always the case, and the best intentions of standardization in NATO were always thwarted by national commercial interests. I think there's no doubt about that whatsoever. Mm. I did an exercise with ACOS G4 at Northern Army Group, a chap who later was one of my great friend of mine, and we sat down, a few of us, and said, now what actually could we expect the British Reinforcement Brigade or division that was supposed to fly into Senelager and land there, just what support that would be available they could instantly use? We came up with 7.62 ammunition, we came up with blood plasma, and we came up with whiskey.
Scotch. And it would be in reverse order, presumably.
But at the end, there were not that many items of equipment that were compatible, in spite of all the so-called Stanags, that they could immediately use. There were a few more, of course, I was just making a point. But it was surprising just how difficult it was to be absolutely standard, which was the ideal thing if you're going to operate and then take over guns or tanks. What about fuel? Were your tanks running on diesel or petrol? Or were they with this ridiculous British insistence on multi-fuel engines, which caused endless problems?
Why is it ridiculous, and why does it cause problems?
The whole idea was you have multi-fuel, and then you had a power pack, and if the engine breaks down, you lift it out, put a new one in. Mm. And the impression I got was that there were not enough power packs to meet the case of, and they tended to break down. Mm. It was much simpler to have all your vehicles using a single fuel. Because if you hadn't got diesel, then you were stuck. But if you hadn't got petrol and you were diesel engines, you were still stuck. And the refueling on exercise was usually quite straightforward. Bowsers came around and topped up your APCs and tanks and things fairly routinely. I couldn't see the need to have a multi-fuel engine. Mm-hmm. Nobody else had them. The others managed perfectly well. But again, that was one thing that was, but they weren't all the same. I mean, ideally, they should have all been diesel or the other way. But they were not always so because of the clash of interests. The clear-cut purpose was to be the same. And then you could take over tanks and use guns, helicopters. Again, there was a wide variation in our day of helicopters. Yeah. Which were the best for what purpose, and we talked about that earlier on, how they were changing, and different ideas. It was an ongoing, complex business, standardization.
What kind of engineering equipment did the Dutch have? Did they make their own bridging, for example? Did they have something like this medium bridge that you mentioned?
They were very interested in buying. They had Bailey Bridge. Mm. They had German pontoons,
yes,
and they were interested in buying the medium girder bridge. Mm. And there was a considerable hard sell going on by sales teams coming around demonstrating. And if I thought the thing, I would say my experience, the medium girder bridge is the way to go, and would talk about that and encourage them. Mm. I wasn't a salesperson, that wasn't my job, but I would take every chance to say that that's a good bit of kit. You should really think about that quite seriously.
And were they interested in this amphibious approach to gap crossing? Because traditionally their defence systems relied on water, didn't it? The water lini, to isolate the centre of old Netherlands, the seven provinces.
Yeah. That was outside, of course, their NATO responsibility. That was a domestic one. Mm. And they had plans to cover bridges, but their problems of gap crossing were exactly the same as ours, because that's their operational area was in Northern Army Group in Germany, butting on to the up to the north. They were north of us. There's the British Corps and then the Netherlands Corps, and then there was a German Corps, and then it was Denmark.
Yes,
And so their area, geographically, was same sort of size, had similar problems. Obviously, there was a variation because of the country. But their tactical crossing problems were very much the same as ours. Mm. There are massive canals and rivers. That was more of a domestic problem, which didn't concern me too closely at that time. Mm.
But it might have had an influence on their approach to river crossings, mightn't it? They'd got that background.
They had plenty of scope for practicing, that's
yes,
for sure.
Quite. But I mean, were they interested in this amphibious approach that you were mentioning, which would give you tactical flexibility in choosing your crossing point or spreading or crossing simultaneously rather than having to bunch around a bridgehead?
Yes. They were. I don't know if they actually bought any of the equipment, again, because that was money would come into that.
Quite.
But they were definitely interested. Mm. But their bridging equipment was a little bit older-fashioned than ours. Mm. Much more, they say, Bailey bridging they did use. The German pontoon bridging and various girder bridges, they would use those. I think I don't know if they later on bought the medium girder bridge or they bought the M2 or the M3, its development. I'm not sure now. That would have certainly been the last 15 years or so if they had. But they were thinking about it, but money was always a problem, money allocated for defence. It was quite a well-off country, but their priorities were slightly different.
Did any major issues come up while you were attached to them as liaison officer?
No, I don't think so. I used to. Their concerns were career ones and their pay and conditions. Mm. My impression was that they were well treated pay wise, but they were very well treated pension wise. They had, I think I'm right in saying, 13 months' pay every year. And 1 month's pay was to cover their holiday, or their leave, their annual holiday. So they were generously paid. I remember talking to one chap just before retirement, and I said, "Well, Case, now what job are you going to do when you retire?" And he looked at me as if I was slightly crazy. He said, "No, I shall retire at 55. I don't need to take a job. My pension is perfectly adequate. And why should I take a job and do some younger person out of work?" So they were not interested, by and large, on second paid careers. Many of them went into politics more closely, and others would take on jobs of interest to help on a voluntary basis. Their local area, they had a lot of history, a lot of preservation of old towns and things worth doing. And there were lots of schemes like that that they liked to get involved in to help preserve the historical past of their particular local area. A mixture of that. But the idea, he was really quite amazed that I shouldn't think of him taking another job. And that generation, the one older than I, were certainly very well off because, first of all, their pensions were excellent. And secondly, they were counted the years of service that they were on active service, say in the war in the Dutch East Indies or elsewhere, counted double. So every month of active service counted for two. So you could finish up actually with a pension almost 100%, if not more, of your pay. But that gives an illustration of their general approach to their pay and living conditions.
What was it like for you living in the Netherlands?
Very good indeed. Very comfortable. They had a nice mess at headquarters, core headquarters in Apeldoorn. Mm. It was treated slightly differently. I used to have lunch there when I was in the headquarters, a very simple lunch. They had a few odd receptions. And they had a flourishing bridge club, which we used to play, and they ran duplicate bridge club. Apart from that, it wasn't a mess as such. Their living accommodation, they mostly lived out. There were bachelor accommodation blocks in most of the garrisons, and people would live there from Monday to Saturday, Friday evening, and then they would commute. Quite a few lived in worked in Apeldoorn would live in, say, Rotterdam or Amsterdam, and they would commute backwards and forwards. Their approach to accommodation was slightly different. They had soldiers' blocks, but then there was no reason why soldiers shouldn't live out. We've come round to that way much more than we had then, but that was noticeable. Like, if I hadn't been married and accompanied, I could have had a bachelor apartment in a block, but it wouldn't have been terribly comfortable. Not like living in nowadays at Santos. that was different. But socially, it was quite interesting. They were very cautious to start with, very correct when I arrived, and obviously all the heads of departments, Chief G3 and so on, would entertain us, but in a very formal, limited way. They would say, come round after dinner and have coffee and a cake and a chat, and then you would go around and do that, so on. And they were very correct. And then after a few months, Beverly said, it's very nice, but it's a bit stiff, apart from our civilian neighbours. And then all of a sudden, at some point, it seemed to us that they had accepted us as nice people socially. And then they indicated, either directly or indirectly, that they wished to be our friends. And from then on, we were almost part and parcel of their families. Instead of being asked for coffee and a cake and then possibly a drink afterwards, you were asked for meals, and then you got involved at lunch parties and family dues, and it got very warm, and we made a lot of very nice friends on the army side, and we made good friends locally with our civilians. Although one could have been briefed slightly better, the thing, if you go to live in Holland, in a house, the first thing you do is put your visiting card through your immediate neighbours. And that indicates that you're there and ready to receive invitations and make contact. No one ever said that, but we found out later that that's what some people had expected us to do, and we didn't. And they were always rather distant. But others who had a more international outlook on their business, took them abroad and so on, living near us in a very nice part of Apeldoorn, were friendly right from the word go and came across and had chats, and we became en famille with them on a daily basis very quickly. And we, for those that are still alive, we still have a lot of friends there. So it was from that point of view, it was very nice. And we had a chance to tour around the country by work, and I had my own car with a driver, which was very helpful for official and even social occasions. Took us all over Holland.
Well, in that sort of post or appointment, social life and duty are very difficult to distinguish, aren't they?
Yes, they were part and parcel. Yeah. I had an entertainment allowance, a modest one. I had a special grant once a year for the Queen's birthday. I got permission from the local authorities to put a flagpole up in my front garden and run up a Union Jack, which is very nice. And then the headquarters mess staff came along and put a big marquee at the back of our house, buttered on, because it was always in the right time of the year. Mm-hmm. And I entertained all the visiting dignitaries in the town and Corps headquarters and people from the MOD in The Hague, and our defence attaché, with whom I worked reasonably closely. I used to visit him, and he would come and see me, and we would exchange notes, and I would have that very big formal party once a year, which they all looked forward to. That was quite an event. Yeah, it was an interesting job. It was a useful job, and it was a very pleasant one. One good, interesting aspect was they were all good at English, but not all of them were as good as they thought they were. And occasionally one was able to interpret in time a mistake in English that could have been unfortunate. You never said anything about it, you just suggested that they change this wording and that wording a little bit for clarity. But that was that popped up occasionally. But one has to say that they were really very keen to learn English and very good. They liked it when we spoke Dutch, but as I said, our opportunities were not quite as good as they ought to have been.
Did you have any opportunity to learn Dutch before you went to
I had several hours instruction, quite a lot, from privately with a lady who taught in the local, who taught Dutch in the evening classes at the local education adult education centre, and Beverly took some lessons, and she had done German, and she knew German better than I did, and she picked up some that way, and we went on with a little bit of Dutch, and it was improving at the beginning, but as our friends got, field of friends got bigger and wider, and as they began to practice their English more, our level of Dutch became rather static and perhaps almost retrograde.
Did you ever get a reading knowledge of it, or was it just speaking?
I could read a bit, yes. And it was very useful because all the briefings in the Dutch Corps were in Dutch.
Yes.
When they were on exercise at Corps headquarters or on the staff exercises at Maastricht, then it was all English. And that was it. But all their own briefings and giving out orders were all in Dutch. And so it was really essential that I could sit there and get the gist of what they were saying, which, by and large, wasn't too difficult because it wasn't a conversation. It was a subject in which I knew what they were talking about, and it was following a sequence of events that I was familiar with. So it was much easier to pick up in fair detail what they were talking about under those circumstances than it sometimes was in a general conversation when you didn't always know what the starting point of the conversation or the subject matter was, if you see what I mean.
Did you have anything to do with the Dutch Navy or Air Force?
I had little to do with the Dutch Navy. I met a couple of naval people socially. I met one or two at the defence attaché's house in The Hague. I had more to do with the Air Force. Most of their helicopter work was run by the Air Force. And I had one or two visits to airfields to see how they got on, what they were doing. And there was an air liaison team at Dutch Corps headquarters, and I became very friendly with Teddy Van Lingen, who ran that, and he was a wing commander in the Dutch, or equivalent in the Royal Dutch Air Force. And they were very useful, and occasionally one got liaison trips in helicopters. There were two famous trips. One, when Harry Tuzer, who was Com Northag, came to visit the Dutch Corps, we had Com Northag, his chief of staff, the Dutch Corps commander, several divisional commanders and brigade commanders, and about four helicopters. And we were flying around and just looking at certain parts of the Dutch area, and we got rather too close to the inner German border. And the weather closed in. It became almost impossible. In fact, it was impossible to fly. And we all came down in a field, luckily on the right side. But that was a close shave. It was pretty awful weather. But that was a point that don't have all your eggs in one basket, or even in four baskets if they're all close together. But I had to go down to Stuttgart.
That would be an American headquarters.
That was an American area, yes. And so a team of us went down, and a Dutch helicopter. It was notable for the length of the flight, and we went straight there. And we were just talking about the American participation in a North Ag exercise, and there was some liaison work to do there. And on the way back, greatest fun, they flew me due west, and then almost up the Rhine. And from a level of Stuttgart, we flew up the Rhine all the way at just above, just high enough above to see the castles from a different point of view and get a wonderful view. It was done specially for me. It was extremely kind of them. And I never forget the sight of beautiful birds of prey, buzzards, being seen from above. You normally see them from below, and you recognize a bird by the spread of feathers at the end, the split on the tail, or whatever. Here we saw them in color, full color, from above. And I never forget that little sight. But that was how they used their helicopters in those days. It was just liaison running VIPs around. They hadn't done much work on offensive use on helicopters.
I was going to ask about whether or not they were up to speed in the same way that you'd mentioned us being at Warminster and so on.
No, they hadn't. They hadn't done anything like that at that time.
What about their approach to the use of armoured personnel carriers, which was something else you had been involved in helping to develop?
They were using, first, older ones were American and then German. Another item of German equipment coming in. Yes, they were using them in very much the same way, except that the kit was not British. And as they had German tanks, German APCs, as they were all moving to, no doubt it seemed quite logical for them. And it certainly made sense from a modest standardization point of view, that should be so.
Do you happen to know if, apart from having this German liaison officer alongside, that there were any contacts on the ground between the Bundeswehr and the Dutch Corps, particularly between that brigade at Hohner and the local German formations?
I think there obviously was, but there were as many British troops at Hohner as there were German.
But, I mean, from the way you've described it, the Dutch would have had us on their southern flank and they'd have had Germans on their left flank.
Oh, yes, they had liaison on that.
Yes.
But that, again, was a bit removed from my operations.
Yes.
But, yes, they had to have that, and we talked about various plans. The one interesting thing in Northern Army Group was the cooperation between engineers. We had a thing, it may still go for all I know, exercise Makefast. It was started by us some years after the end of the war. Chief engineer in BOR thought that it would be a good idea if the Northern Army Group engineers got together on a regular basis to discuss common problems, make presentations, a little bit of training, and it gradually evolved into a three-day get-together with a very good social life, but there was a theme for each period, studying this, and it would be done, and then there would be syndicate discussion, and then a main discussion. There would be demonstrations of equipment of the host country. And exercise Makefast was held in the British Corps area. It was sometimes, when we did it, it was held at Chatham. There was an exercise, the Germans held it at Munich. No, sorry, it wasn't Munich, it was somewhere else. It was, I forget now, sorry, it was a mistake. And then the Dutch would have it at their engineer center, and then the Belgians would host it. And we would take it in turns, and so every, fourth year it would be the Dutch one. And those were excellent ways of meeting your fellow engineers, exchanging ideas in discussion and on problems common to us all, seeing each other's equipment and noting our changes and doing a bit of hands-on stuff, and then generally socialising. I don't know if any of the other arms, if the artillery and tanks did a similar sort of thing. I've never heard of it, but they may well have done, but certainly Makefast was a well-known and well-liked feature of engineer life in NATO.
Did you find that as engineers you all had a common mentality or a mentality that overlapped to a considerable extent in the way you thought about things?
That's a difficult question to answer. I got on with our engineers. They were very interested in showing me what they were doing, very proud of what they were doing. I wouldn't say that they were thinking exactly like that. There was perhaps less emphasis on being soldiers first and engineers second than we tend to make, and that my experience tended to reinforce. I got on just as well as with their armour and artillery and infantry as I did with the engineers. And I made a point, in fact, if you like, of being that way so that I wouldn't be seen to favour the engineer school above anybody else. Perhaps diplomacy interfered with that.
I think after this posting, your next posting was back to Chatham. Had you expected that?
Well, again, I didn't know quite